Hello everyone and welcome to another brilliant Sport and Lifestyle Beers here on UK Health Radio, your real feel good radio. This week we've got a mixture of people. We start off with a musical superstar, Professor Green, not talking about his music, but talking about a very important cause, data poverty. We then move on to a replay of our interview with a South African cricket star, Faye Tunnicliffe, and we finish off with someone brand new to the show, 15-year-old Holly Mile, going through the karting ranks and now in the Ginetta Junior Championship. Holly tells us about how she got started in a brilliant part one of her interview. Throw in our SLB Sports Roundup and we know you're going to love the show. Well, everybody, today I'm actually joined by a superstar musician. It's Professor Green. Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well, mate. How are you?
Oh, I'm perfect. Thank you, Stephen. I appreciate it. Well, sadly, you're not here to talk about your music, but you're actually here to talk about a worrying subject, which not all parents are aware of or even suffer from. It's the importance of the data bank of mum and dad. You're getting behind a campaign to tackle data poverty. So for people that are unaware of this, please let us know what that is about and some of the measures we're going to try and help it.
Yeah, so the campaign that I'm here to raise awareness of, Network 3 have partnered with Good Things Foundation and, in this instance, the National Data Bank, which provides free prepaid SIMs that you wouldn't otherwise be able to afford them or be afforded connectivity. And connectivity is so important, especially in this day and age, and not in the case, in the instance of new parents, it's incredibly important, but not just for what people would expect, you know, not just because you want to stream an episode of Peppa Pig or Bluey to give you 15 minutes respite or allow you to cook dinner or examine a room and make sure there's no imminent dangers for your child or dan.
Yes.
But data poverty is such a huge problem. 30% of all households in the UK now exist in poverty. People live in poverty, right?
Yeah.
And 85% of low-income households say connectivity is an issue. I don't mean they've got a problem with the router. I mean they quite simply cannot afford connectivity.
Right.
Immediately, that's a barrier between so many things. Throughout COVID, so much shifted to being online. That's not reverted. If anything, even more.
Yeah.
Is becoming online. And whether that's databases, doctor appointments, job applications, courses, education, tools for children. There's just so much to this that data poverty gets in the way of people accessing.
And as you said, we're not just talking about people having a little stream to give themselves 10 minutes break from looking after the kids or anything. It's actually real relevant stuff because the whole world, as you said, since COVID or during COVID, has reverted to internet / online. That hasn't reverted back. I mean, we've almost been converted to doing stuff on our phones. So you said you're partnering up with Three and that gives data SIM cards to families.
Yes, so by way of Good Things Foundation and the National Data Bank, they provide SIM cards prepaid to people who wouldn't otherwise be able to afford them. So that affords their mobile data, texts and calls.
Which is fabulous. And data does get drained if you're not on Wi-Fi, doesn't it? You know, it's not just your simple if you're streaming, but searching for things to do, places to go, taking photos and videos, WhatsApp, it all drains it down very quickly.
It does, and you mentioned WhatsApp, you know, that's obviously something that we use, a medium we use to connect with people. And, you know, when we talk about networks and connectivity, what's really important to highlight here is imagine parenting as new parents, it can become incredibly isolating. Poverty can as well. The combination of those two things.
Yeah.
Further made worse by exclusion, you know, not being able to contact your network, your friends, your family, your social network. I don't mean social network platform, you know, but not having the freedom of being able to contact people. I don't just mean for a chit chat, but sometimes times of need, which there are many, especially during those first months of
absolutely. And exclusion, I think, is a very underrepresented form of poor mental health or struggling with your mental health, because that automatically puts you on the back foot as well, because the best thing to do, as we know, is to talk. And if you've got no method of contact, that obviously is a massive burden for people.
Huge.
So obviously it's a great thing. I know Three are a decent network as well. I think they command nearly 30% now of the UK traffic, which is pretty good. And I think they've actually increased their network. They cover nearly the whole of the UK now.
Yeah, which again is a problem for people in more remote areas.
Yeah.
So not only are they helping people who can't afford connectivity yet, they provide connectivity to people who live in the hardest to reach of areas.
Great. And we're not only highlighting new parents, but we know having young children and being a new parent, generally, you do have an increase in your usage of phone. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Stephen, if that's okay. How much did you increase the use of your phone?
I mean, my Google search has changed a hell of a lot. And I found myself on Google searching things a hell of a lot more, not least of all when, you know, scary things present themselves, only to find out that they weren't scary. I was just scared because I was uninformed or ill-informed as a new parent. And that happens a lot. There's so much that comes up. And then further down the line, when it comes to weaning and stuff like that, there's so many brilliant educational videos that help you understand what to do at the right time. And when is the right time? And how do you tell when it's the right time? You have so many silly questions. I can't think of any off the top of my head that I'm not too embarrassed to tell you. But you asked the internet some really ridiculous things for me in hindsight as a new parent. But it's unsurprising, and it's actually a really nice way to educate yourself. As long as you make sure that you're using credible platforms and you're researching things properly, it's a really great way to be able to access information around parenting. And especially when it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you're panicked and you're alone, your partner's not at home. And as a dad as well. Generation Y, us millennials, I was born in 83, so we're spending up to 3 times the time the previous generations were spending with their kids. So we're learning on our feet a lot, but it's nice to have access to information which further helps that learning.
Brilliant. And you make a couple of really great points there. First of all, it is educational. You can use it to educate yourself if you are feeling a little bit worried about, oh, is it a stupid question? And, you know, being a parent myself and sort of having come out of the other side of having young children, if that makes sense, you do feel a bit stupid. And if you are on your own, you do feel a little bit isolated. But there's no manual as a parent. My main worry was, will I be a good dad? And you just muddle through, don't you? Do you know what I mean? Whether it's a good time or a bad time. So having the internet to educate yourself on doing the right thing is brilliant. And having this initiative is even better for those families out there who you said can't afford it.
Indeed, yeah.
So you're very passionate about this, which is lovely to see. You know, a big star like yourself being involved is a great thing. But why are you so passionate about this initiative?
I've become a father recently. I grew up in a low-income household, which is a way of saying I grew up poor. You know, my grandmother brought me up. There were 6 of us in a 3-bedroom flat when I was born. That quickly changed as her kids started to leave home.
Yeah.
And I was brought up by my grandmother. And it was difficult. And it came with all the difficulties that growing up poor does. I became successful in music when I was 28. It's a long time.
Yeah.
And so my anxieties will always be that of the working class. I will always have working class anxieties. But now I have a platform.
Wonderful.
And can use my voice to raise awareness to and hopefully bring about some change to things that I care about. And, you know, poverty was something I saw everywhere growing up. You know, I grew up in Hackney, right? And everyone goes, oh my God, Hackney, I'd love to live there, or I do live there. And it's like, well, you wouldn't have lived there when I was growing up.
No.
You wouldn't have been able to live there when I was growing up. Going from a place you couldn't pay people to live because it was so undesirable to now being a place that people can't afford to live.
Yeah.
People say it's so different now, and on the face of it, it is, but I imagine that growing up in the flats there now is worse than it was because you have essentially your face pushed up against a window.
Yeah.
All of these new coffee shops and all of these things opening due to the gentrification, which has pros and cons like anything.
Yeah.
But you can't access them. You can't frequent them because you can't use them. The idea of £3.50 for a coffee to you is mind-blowing.
You're exactly right. I mean, I had a similar thing to you when I was growing up. Not so much the fact as many brothers and sisters, which I didn't have, but my parents divorced when I was early. So my nan brought me up, to be fair. She was with me constantly. So I do know the pressures of not being brought up by your actual parents. So it's great that you're behind this so much. Just give us a little bit about data poverty. What is the actual real issue and how common is it, to be fair?
It's sadly quite common. 30% of all households in the UK live in poverty. 85% of those households, of low-income households, say connectivity is an issue.
Yeah.
If people are struggling and have access to the internet, please visit goodthingsfoundation.org for more information. Or if internet is a problem or you want to simply speak to someone, in person, please pop into your local branch of three.
Brilliant. And that's great. And that was my next question, actually. Where should people turn to? So it's visit goodthingsfoundation.org if they've got access to the internet, or just pop into your local three store, usually on pretty much every high street, and they'll be able to help you as well.
Indeed, yeah.
Brilliant. Well, we actually look like we've come to the end of the time slot, which is a real shame, because it's been a real pleasure to speak to you. Love to have you back on sometime if you've got time to talk about your music, but also about how this is going, how the campaign's going, to update people. We'll get it put out there on our social media for the radio and for the show.
Thank you.
No problem at all. You know, it would be great perhaps staying in touch. I know you're probably very busy, but if we can get an update and get you on again, that would be great.
Lovely. I'm sure there'll be reason to in the future, definitely.
Absolutely fabulous. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Stephen Manderson, aka Professor Green, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it, mate. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
Well, everybody, today I've got a really special interview with you. A young, good cricket talent. It's Faye Tunnicliffe, all the way from South Africa. She currently plays for Western Province. Hi, Faye. How are you?
Hi, John. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Really well, thank you. Lovely and exciting to have you on the show. Appreciate your time very much.
Yeah, great. Thank you for having me.
Brilliant. No problem. This is our first interview with you. But just so everybody gets to know you a little bit better, if you could just tell me, Faye, when you were growing up, when did you realise you had a love for cricket? Was it an instant love, or was it something that actually grew on you?
So I grew up around cricket. My granddad was an umpire. He did quite a lot of umpiring here in South Africa. His base was at the Wanderers Stadium. And my uncle, Trevor Tunnicliffe, he played cricket for Nottinghamshire. So he played for the Outlaws back in the day. And yeah, it was sort of always around my family. We were always watching cricket. I would play in the back garden with my dad and with my brother.
Yep.
And then yeah, I was good at it, but I wouldn't say I really saw it as a career option. And then I think I was about 11 years old and I was at school and I was talking to one of my friends at the time and he was just saying how, no, you know, girls don't play cricket. And I don't know, what did something sort of clicked inside me and I just said, well, tell the coach I'll be at the next practice then. And I just started playing cricket with the guys at school and then sort of grew from there. I got picked up for provincial and yeah, just sort of grew from there. And then I just fell in love with the game. I didn't even know that girls cricket was really a thing. And then I got introduced to that. I got selected for provincial and then grew from strength to strength, really, and fell in love with the game. And lucky enough to still be in love with the game a good sort of 14 years later. Pretty standard story, but I just like the idea of someone challenged me on it and I sort of stuck to my guns.
Yeah, brilliant, Faye. A couple of things, actually, that you mentioned there that I'd just like to perhaps touch on. First of all, you said you played in the back garden, which I hear a lot, especially in football as well, with your brother. Is your brother older? And if he is, did you have to do the bowling all the time or going to fetch the ball?
So, yeah, my brother is older than me. Actually, he hated cricket.
Oh, okay.
I think he would just play for the fun of it. And I think my mum was quite chuffed because, obviously, with her dad being an umpire and her brother played as well. So she spent quite a lot of her childhood next to a cricket field. I was quite chuffed when my brother said, nah, I'm not really interested in cricket.
Yeah.
And then she thought, I don't have to spend my days next to a cricket field. And then I came along and I said, well, actually, I quite like cricket. So she still spends her days next to the cricket field.
So she thought that was done and then suddenly you threw a fly in the ointment.
Exactly, yeah.
Lovely. And something else you brought up was, and again, something that I hear quite a lot from the people that tend to do better in women's sport, not always, but it was the fact that you were challenged, or girls don't play cricket, that almost lit your ignition, almost thought, yes, I'm going to go and do it and prove him wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sort of in contact with him every now and then. Yeah. Every time I see him, I still tease him about it. And I say, you know, I owe my career to you because you challenged me that one day when we were however old, 11 years old or something. Yeah. And yeah, that's sort of something that just stuck with me. Yeah. And now if somebody tells me that I can't do something, then see it as a challenge. And I like to see it as healthy competition.
Oh, that's great, Faye. Well, two things from that is don't tell him that too much or he'll be asked a commission for your career. And secondly, I know now how to get you to perform at your best. I'll just phone you up before a game and tell you that you can't do it.
Yeah, exactly.
No, that's wonderful. That's lovely to hear. Thank you for that. Obviously, you said that your granddad was an umpire at the Wanderers, amazing ground. Your uncle played for Nottinghamshire. So were they your main inspirations getting into it, or did you have any others in the game?
I think I really sort of enjoyed, you know, watching players like AB de Villiers. I'm a massive Sachin Tendulkar.
Yeah.
That's mostly for his sort of philosophies off the field. He's pretty big on how you treat people off the field is sort of how you'll be remembered. And yeah, I really like that. Virat Kohli is one of my favourite players, Faf du Plessis as well.
Yeah.
I mean, lucky enough, they're still sort of going. Yeah, I wouldn't say I have sort of a main inspiration. I mean, my uncle, he inspired me. He played alongside Clive Rice as well. And yeah, sort of as families, we were quite close. So I think it was just being surrounded by really driven people who sort of did pretty well in the cricket fraternity. Yeah, and then also within the women's game, Laura Volfart and I played under 13 provincial cricket together. And we've sort of been mates from there. And obviously she took off. She's a phenomenal cricketer and she sort of took off. And then I would watch the ladies, like Jenny Gunn. I remember watching England versus South Africa at Newlands. And I was completely starstruck. I think I still have a photo alongside Mignon Dupria and Danae Funny-Kak.
Yeah.
And I was a spectator. And then it's quite cool to look back because then a couple of years later, I took a very similar photo when we were in the West Indies. We took the photo as teammates. So I had all of these people to look up to and strive to be like.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm still striving, but I'm lucky to sort of, you know these people personally.
Yes.
And to think one day, well, back in the day, I used to look up to them and idolize them. It's quite a cool feeling.
Yeah, absolutely it is. Absolutely. And it must be. You mentioned that you went and played cricket at school with the boys, and the fact that you didn't even know that girls' cricket was really a thing, which sadly I still think is the case in a lot of areas over here, which is a real shame. Something I want to try and change, or even be part of something that tries to change that. Did you find, again, that the opportunities for girls were limited or non-existent, and did you have to play with the boys for quite a while until you were picked up by the team you said?
Yeah, absolutely. There was no girls' cricket in the schools that I went to in my sort of primary school and high school.
Yeah.
So all throughout my school career, I'd been in the boys' teams. I was the only girl playing at school. So I saw the inside of more boys' changing rooms than I think I would have liked to.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think even now it is getting going, but I think a lot more can be done to sort of specifically in this country to build the pipeline of women's cricket, because that's how we're going to go from strength to strength. And I think worldwide is the same. I believe over in the UK, it is getting a bit better.
Yeah.
But I think here, girls are limited to softball cricket. And then once it gets to playing with a hardball, then they're pretty much told that they can't do it.
Yeah, it's pretty sad, really, because the only way they're going to get proper introduction and a proper feel for the actual game is by playing with the correct equipment, isn't it? And putting them out there. That's the only way you're going to see the ones that can step up to achieve and potentially become professionals, rather than playing it just as a gentle game, really.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think I was lucky enough to be stubborn, where, you know, I was told that, no, I had to play netball or hockey or water polo, sort of one of these, like, all-girls sports. And I just said, no, I'm playing cricket. And
yeah,
I really made the schools much of a choice. But I don't think there's many girls. I mean, being a teenager is hard enough, but now trying to stand up for yourself and play in an all-boys team as a young girl, it's hard enough. So I think we really just need to open up a space for girls to just be themselves and play cricket unapologetically.
I totally agree with that. And that's what we try to do differently with football. Biggest difference between men's and women's football, or soccer as some people call it, it's not the fact that it's even tougher. It's the fact that the men move the ball a lot quicker. And that is grown from grassroots when they're young, because boys move the ball a lot quicker than girls. And we just coach the girls as footballers rather than girls, which is why we haven't got a team. We go into tournaments in the summer and we win most of them, because our girls play like boys, as it were. Even though I don't want to describe it like that, that is effectively what it is. Some of the girls that don't get into the bigger teams over here, we actually encourage to go into boys' teams, because even though for me that's not ideal, it's the way they're going to stand up, actually realise if they're going to make an academy team. And again, it's because there's either not enough coaching at a young age, not enough of it in schools, and it's played as long as you turn up, that's good. Now, and I don't want to come across as harsh, but for me, you've got to be trained as champions. And that's it. And it's good to see that it's starting to get better in cricket over here. I hope it is in South Africa.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears. Beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, Mum and Dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
I'm not sure if it's the same over there, but over here it's sort of like you have a talent and you get picked up and then you're thrown in the deep end because you're expected to perform maybe a more senior team than what you're used to, just because there aren't those grassroots levels where you can sort of come through the ranks. You know, like it'll be sort of 15, 16 year old that shows a bit of talent, and then she's picked up for a senior side, whether it's club or provincial or like a national side. And I think if we can just find those skills early on and develop them, then they'll get to a stage where they're willing to and ready to step into a professional space rather than throwing them in the deep, breaking their confidence, and then making them not really want to play cricket. That's allowing them to enjoy the game, because I fully believe that there is a time and a place to take the game seriously. But when you're young and just playing for fun, then that's not the time to sort of all this pressure on you and be expected to perform. That's when you should really just find your love for the game. And we need to give young women a platform to do that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And it's lovely to hear that somebody like yourself, who's invested in the game, who plays the game, sees that as well. Now, it's lovely to hear, which we'll come back to again later on. I want to have a little chat about you, actually, now, your career, if that's okay. Your first club was a team called Boland, where you stayed for 4 years. How important was the experience and the education in terms of your growth in girls' cricket, women's cricket, and your career?
Yeah, so in South Africa we say it's like Boland, but I understand it's different. It's a very Afrikaans
name. Sorry, apologies.
No, that's completely fine. Yeah, so Boland was massive for my development as a cricketer and as a person. Yeah, I played along some of the previous South African players. There was Alicia Smith, Sunette Lopesha, Musaline Daniels. I played with them at Boland at a very young age, and they sort of set the foundation for me, because they came from an era of sort of hard cricketers where, you know, you don't complain, you don't say that you're sore, you don't say that you're tired, you just do the work that you need to do. And I think Alicia Smith won ICC Cricketer of the Year around 2009. She was a phenomenal cricketer. And growing up playing alongside her, I used to tell myself that I wanted to be the next Alicia Smith.
Okay.
And just also off the field, she was such a real person. She calls a spade, she'll tell you when you do something wrong, but she'll also tell you when you do something right. And being a youngster growing up around these people, I think I played for them for the first time when I was about 14 or 15, which are fundamental development years. And playing in this team was almost starstruck, because we had such a high standard for ourselves. Well, they held everyone to a very high standard. So it was, if you slack off, then you let the team down. Yeah, I really enjoyed my years there. And then a couple of things changed. I'd come out of high school, I was studying, and I just thought it was maybe time to sort of move on. And then that's when I moved over to Western Province. I think that was about 4 years ago now.
Yeah, that's great to hear. Great that you had a good experience, a learningful experience, and it really helped you in your career. And I was going to say, obviously, towards the end of that stint you were there, you were selected for South Africa's World T20 squad, which followed by you being named in the One Day International Series versus Sri Lanka, where you actually made your debut in February 2019. What was the feeling like to be selected when you got the call and then pull on the team kit for the first time?
It's such a fond memory. Because I think I was at home, I was at my folks' place, still living at home at the time. And because I was 19 when I got the call up for the tour to the West Indies, playing T20 cricket, and then the same year for the World Cup.
Yeah,
I was in my room, and I mean, I can't say all the words that I said over the radio, but I got the phone call, and the selector said, "Are you available to come to the West Indies and play for South Africa?" And I ran down the corridor, and I screamed a couple of words, and I said, "Mom and Dad, I'm going to the West Indies." I think everyone just started crying at that stage, myself included. Yeah, because, you know, that season I had been really sort of hard on myself and tried to be as professional as possible and just enjoying my cricket. And I was performing, and it sort of just gave me a sense of, like, all of this hard work and all the sacrifices, this could all pay off. Yeah, but that was an amazing feeling. I don't think I will ever forget that phone call. It's just awesome. And then put on the kit. I mean, I was starstruck when I was in the change room, because these people that you've been watching on TV, that you've been, you know, following on Instagram and stuff, like,
yeah.
I was that cricketer who had other cricketers as my wallpaper on my phone. These people that I had had as a wallpaper were now my teammates in the change room. And yeah, I was completely starstruck. And yeah, I think it's weird because now, upon reflection, I look back, I wish I had taken it in more. Because at the time, I was sort of putting a lot of pressure on myself and thinking, you need to perform, you need to do well and all this. But I kind of want to go back and just remind myself to enjoy the moment. Yeah, and my debut was in Barbados. And I'm not going to lie, I hardly remember it. Like, it went by in a flash. But yeah, that tour was very special, and playing the World Cup that year as well.
Yes.
I mean, what an honour. That's like the highest honour for cricketers, to play a World Cup.
Of course, yeah.
It was phenomenal, yeah.
Absolutely fantastic to hear, and lovely that you're so passionate about it. And obviously that was on the back of your 2018 intake into the Powerade Women's National Academy. Being named as one of those chosen players must have been special, must have been an honour for you.
Yeah, and it was a little bit unexpected, so things kind of happened quite quickly.
Yeah.
I had a pretty good season at Woodland, and then I got called up to this, and we had a try series with Australian and the English women's team. And it was the tour, and then it was the academy.
Yeah.
Things sort of just happened really quickly. And that was my first sort of taste of real professional sport and how a professional athlete should act, and, you know, what they should eat and what their day should look like and all of that fitness, like that side of things. So it was a very cool experience. And I think that pretty much shaped how I wanted to be going forward as an athlete.
Yeah, lovely, lovely to hear. And then, again, following the Sri Lanka series, you were also named in the, and I've probably pronounced this wrong, apologies, Devonian 11 squad for the inaugural Women's T20 League in South Africa. Another fantastic experience.
Yeah, that was brilliant. That whole league, I think, has kick-started something very good in women's cricket in this country.
Yeah.
That league was good fun. I mean, just so your provincial teammates are now, you're playing against them.
Yes.
And I think in the UK, it's quite normal for people to experience that, and for cricketers to experience sort of playing against their own teammates in these various different leagues. But I think for us, it was the first experience like that.
Yeah.
Which, it just shapes you differently as a cricketer, because if you're around and playing for the same team the whole time, playing with the same people, you become complacent. So now you suddenly learn all different aspects to yourself and to your game, because you're playing against the people that you're usually playing with. And yeah, that tournament is also just a lot of fun. It's a good excuse to just fully enjoy your cricket, not put too much pressure on yourself.
Yeah, lovely. It seemed like that over here. You know, obviously people want to go and win it, but you're quite correct. It's something new, it's something different, it's something exciting. You get all the good players playing against each other rather than together in their same team. So yeah, something very, very nice. So we move on now to 2021, when you were part of the emerging talent squad and teams for the tour to Bangladesh and Thailand. However, that was during a world of COVID. What experience was that like?
The Bangladesh tour, I won't lie, was very emotionally taxing. Previously, I was on the India tour as well before that. And going from one COVID bubble to the next, it was very taxing. And I'm the type of person who, I need my head to be right for my game to be right.
Okay.
And feeling of sort of being indoors and, you know, being told you can't leave your room, you can't go out, and we were in such beautiful country. It was difficult because I want to go and learn about the culture, I want to learn about the people, but the only commute that we really had was from the hotel to the ground and back.
Right, yeah.
I mean, it was a good time to sort of get closer to the team and get to know my teammates a bit better. But yeah, COVID was a hard time, and I felt very sorry for the athletes that were constantly traveling. So they were constantly exposed to this COVID bubble, and they couldn't go out, couldn't see family, couldn't see friends. Yeah, it wasn't the best time to be an athlete.
No, I mean, it was a horrible time for everybody around the world, but sport, it really sort of messed up with. You had what you loved taken away from you, then you were given it back, but in these real weird, strange circumstances. During this time, though, you indicated to it in your last answer that for you personally, your head has to be right for you to play your best. How did you keep yourself physically and mentally strong during such a difficult time?
So the initial sort of lockdown that we had for COVID, we had a 3-week hard lockdown here at home. So nothing was happening. Everything was shut. I mean, selfishly, it was actually quite a good time for me. I was at home with my folks at the time, and we had quite like a big garden. So I just made the most of it. I was doing a lot of exercise. I just pretty much poured my energy into that. I was finishing up my studies, so I was finishing up my diploma. And, yeah, I was exercising about twice a day. I was meditating. I was, you know, studying, so I kept busy. And then on tours, it was, again, also just exercise. I am quite passionate about health and fitness.
Yes.
Kept myself busy with that, kept my mind busy with reading, and puzzles were also quite a big thing. I love building puzzles. So that really helped when we were on tour, sort of when we weren't allowed to leave our room. So just sort of trying to keep myself as busy as possible. Yeah, keeping in contact with family and friends. That was very important, just to sort of do those check-ins and make sure everyone around you is okay and healthy.
Yeah, and it was a difficult time. And then during COVID, when you were playing during the bubbles, I presume that was extremely difficult.
Yeah, so that's when the puzzles would come into play, and reading and finding any series under the sun to watch, because there were quite a few recommendations going around. Staying in a hotel room when we went to India, I think it was a 6 or 7 day sort of hard lockdown, where the only time we could leave our room was when we were getting a COVID test and ordering food in. And that was quite mentally taxing, and it taught me a lot about myself. But yeah, with that, it was just keeping busy, doing exercise, trying to, I don't know, run around your room, or like doing shadow batting and that sort of thing, or bouncing a ball off the wall just to make sure I didn't bounce off the walls.
I'm not laughing because it's funny. You know, it was a very trying time, and I know it was hard for a lot of people, whether you were doing what you loved or you weren't even. So it's just interesting to hear how the methods that you used that adapted your life to. So we're happy that obviously we're in a state of coming back. We're trying to repair the world. We're back playing cricket, which is lovely to see. What are your hopes and dreams for the future from now on?
I would like to be a more permanent fixture in the South African side. Yeah, that's really my ultimate goal at the moment. You know, being consistently selected, but also consistently performing. Because I feel like for the longest time, my goal was to be selected. But, you know, there's something after selection and performance. So focus now really is performance. So I'd like to win games for my country, and I'd like to really represent South Africa. We're such a diverse country, and I think that's something that I'd really like to drive my game with. Yeah, just take that pride and really put it into my game. Yeah, win games for my country and just enjoy it as well.
You play in a specialist position, Faye. What was your decision to take up that role?
Wicketkeeping.
Yes.
Yeah, wicketkeeping. There was sort of a gap in the market, if I can put it that way. I started at school with the boys, you know, keep at school because I enjoyed diving around. That was literally my reasoning. And I took the gloves at school and sort of went on from there. And then Borland needed a wicketkeeper, so I got pulled in there. Yeah, and then the more coaching I did for wicketkeeping, they told me I mustn't dive around as much. So I was quite disappointed.
No, that's lovely. It is a specialist position, and one that you do get a lot of criticism for. I think you're expected to do more than most because you've got a pair of gloves on, but it still doesn't make you a robot. Yeah, I imagine it's quite difficult, especially with the ball moving around so much and different spinning options and stuff like that. So fair play to you. It's a very specialist position, and lovely that you're doing it so well and you still enjoy it so much.
Yeah, it's been on and off, to be honest, because I'm fairly tall, so I bowl a little bit as well. But yeah, batting will forever be my first love.
Yes, of course, scoring the runs. So yeah, finally, Faye, what would your advice to any youngsters be, especially girls wanting to get into cricket?
My thing would definitely be just be resilient and, you know, hold fast and stay true to what you want to do and what young girls want to do. Because there's always going to be people that are telling you that you can't do certain things, and, you know, there's a bunch of people that are getting doubt what you do. But I'm a firm believer that, you know, we shouldn't add ourselves to the list of people that doubt us. We just need to back ourselves. Also, to really just enjoy every step, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. These are all going to build you up to be the cricketer that you would like to be one day. And like I said earlier on, there's a time and a place to be hard on yourself, and that's maybe one day when you're getting paid to play the game, or if it's really crunch time, if you're in a serious... Yeah, at school and sort of leading up to that professional phase, that those are the days that you're going to look back on fondly and just really relish and enjoy those memories. Because those are the most important ones. And yeah, just enjoying every moment on the cricket field.
Brilliant. Well, wonderful advice. Great words, Faye. Thank you. Sadly, I believe that's the end of the interview. I'd love to have you on again. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I just want to say for today, Faye Tunnicliffe, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, John.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living. We've been doing this for over 40 years. Every year, more and more people are living satisfying lives completely cruelty-free. Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Well, everybody, with me here today is an inspirational young lady. She's a motor racing star. It's Janetta Junior's Holly Myatt. Hi, Holly, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Brilliant, lovely. Thank you for joining us. Lovely to have you on the show. You know, we just want to talk to you about your racing, about how you got into it, and just to see perhaps how far you can go in the future. So we get to know you a little bit better. Growing up, when did you find that your love was motorsport? What age were you introduced, and did you have any inspirations?
I've always been around motorsport from quite a young age because my dad, when he was younger, did like bits and pieces of karting and to take me to Rye House.
Okay.
We used to go watch touring cars quite often.
Brilliant. So you've always sort of been in it. Obviously followed your dad through his interests. Rye House, yeah. They used to do Speedway there as well. Very good place. Obviously that was a very young age. When was it you got into karting yourself, which was your first port of call on the ladder?
I did Bambino karting at Wilton Mill.
Yes.
That just kind of taught me how to drive. I was 5 or 6 when I did that.
Okay, wow, that's very young.
And then for my 6th birthday, I got lessons going to test a hire car at Brentwood.
Okay.
And then for my 7th birthday was when I got my first car.
Oh, wow. That was a good birthday then.
Yeah.
Brilliant. You touched on Bambino karting, which probably is what it sounds like, is a youngster development centre for karting.
Kind of. It's an actual, series, isn't it?
Okay.
Like, you get different classes in karting. So you have Bambino, which is little.
Yes.
And then you go for cadets, and then mini-max, and then juniors and seniors.
You said you got your first kart when you were 7, tested when you were 6. So you must have been 4 or 5 when you started Bambinos. For people not into motorsport or into motorsport in that depth, it must be quite hard to understand a little person that age driving around in a car. What was it like the first time you sat in a car?
I mean, it's quite a weird thing when you think of it. I was 4 years old.
It's crazy. It
doesn't happen very often.
No.
But I just, when I got my first car, because I got a Bambino, my own Bambino, for my birthday when I was 7.
Okay.
It was literally the day after that, straight away, we went down to Bayford Meadows to test.
Okay, did you? Wow. And that's the sort of place where you can just pay for a bit of track time?
Yeah, you'd share the track with other drivers as well, but you get to go out, yeah.
Wow, that must have been so exciting. I can just tell, obviously people can't see your face, but I can tell everybody that Holly is beaming, just thinking about it. Brilliant. Just touching on a subject before we move on to as you progress through the ladder, I coach a lot of girls' football, and even though it's getting bigger because of the Lionesses, I still find that girls are at the bottom of the totem pole. Boys do get so many opportunities. Obviously, motorsport is a little bit different because it's financed, because obviously nothing's free in motorsport. But what were the opportunities like? Did you actually find people either not taking you seriously, or did you get any sort of negative comments from people because you were a girl?
I think it definitely happens, but personally, I never really had anything.
That's good.
Like, it's definitely a male-dominated sport, but from starting it young, it was never really something I took much notice of.
No, of course not. That's a good thing to say, because obviously we don't need stuff like that around. And I suppose the best way to answer it anyway is on the track. Doesn't matter what people say to you, it's just being good on the track. And obviously you progress through the ranks to Project 1 cadets. which can, yeah. And then continue this. In 2018, you competed in the British Karting Championship before joining the Callum Hargrave Driver Development Programme and completed your ARCS, or ARKS, to enable you to drive anywhere in British motorsport. This was for the 2019 season. Obviously, you were at the time, what, 11? What a fabulous achievement. I mean, you must have been, obviously, very proud of what you achieved.
Yeah. Because before that, I was literally just doing test days around Bayford Meadows. We spoke to Callum Hargrave, and it was the Bambino Karting Championship, which was run by Darren Beavers.
Okay.
I did that for 2018. I came fifth in that, and then I moved on for 2019 to racing with Callum. From the Bambino Karting Championship, I had the opportunities to race in Spain.
Right, okay.
Flew out to Spain for a weekend.
That was just a one-off race weekend. What an experience that must have been.
Great.
Fabulous. And tell us, we said you got your ARCS, your ARKS, which obviously gives you your licence to drive, or your certificates to drive. Tell us what you have to go through to pass that. It must be quite a vigorous test, really.
I think it is just down to being, like, aware and, like, throwing flags and things like that.
Yeah.
It's one of the things, like, where you think of it as, if you know how to drive a car and you have, like, somewhat knowledge, you'll be all right.
Yeah. It's still processing the fact that you're only 10 or 11 at the time. So you haven't got the knowledge of just popping out and driving your car, if that makes sense. The only time you can practice is if you pay for some test time, yeah. So still amazing, you know, at your age to do that. And then we move on to 2020, which is around about COVID. So obviously things are a little bit up in the air. But you signed for Jack's Motorsport team and competed well for them. Please tell us how you continued your development in racing. Was it through help from outside? Was it just your drive to get better? Was it making your body stronger or fitter? What was it you felt was the key to keep improving? Because you obviously you've improved every year.
I think the main thing to improve is just seat time. It's just getting experience and being out in a car as much as you can. Through 2020 and 2021 was the first year I started properly doing, like, national races.
Yes.
Over the country and that, and, like, in a team that was a bit more, like, progressive.
Yes.
And I had better data, and it was just a bit more, like, progressed than what I'd originally been in.
Right. So that obviously got you to read a race as well, if that makes sense, but not just how I'm doing. You know, you could go back and, as you said, you had data to look at and perhaps see where you could be a bit faster. So that helps you, I suppose, develop your mind as well, which means you become a better driver. So you then entered the Ginetta Junior Scholarship, competing with over 65 drivers, but obviously continued to flourish. I mean, 65 is a lot of cars on the track. You've got to be mindful, but obviously quick as well. So much so that you decided to enter the Michelin Ginetta Junior Championship this year with Fox Motorsport. Please let us know the difference between the Bambinos, the carts you were driving, to the actual cars that you're driving now.
I'd say they're definitely harder to drive in a way. Like, you need to be more physically fit and you need to be a lot more, like, focused. It's not just a strain physically, it's a massive strain mentally.
Yes.
But I wouldn't say that it's as, like, punishing on your body as karting was.
We finish off this week's show with our SLB Sports Roundup featuring world athletics, golf, horse racing, tennis, motorsport and football. We start with the World Athletics Championships from Hungary that have just finished. Team USA unsurprisingly dominating the whole seedings, finishing up with 29 medals, 12 gold, 8 silver and 9 bronze. Team GB done themselves really proud, finishing with 10 medals, 2 gold, 3 silver and 5 bronze. In golf, it was the final event of the PGA season with the Tour Championship from Eastlake Golf Course in Atlanta, Georgia, where they had the staggered start. Scottie Scheffler started in front on minus 10, second was Victor Hovland on minus 8, and it's done on how well the golfers have performed all season. Well, Victor Hovland continued that, shooting 19 under par for the tournament and a 27 under par total, winning by 5 shots from Xander Schauffele, who also shot 19 under for the tournament, but started 5 shots further back. Third place was Wyndham Clark on minus 16. They're back now on the 14th to the 17th of September with a 14A championship from the Silverado Resort and Spa. The DP World Tour held the D&D Real Czech Masters from the Albatross Golf Resort in the Czech Republic and was won by young up-and-coming star Todd Clements. He shot a final round of minus 9 to finish on minus 22, one shot clear of Matt Wallace with a further 3 back to Nikolai Højgaard on minus 18. This week it's the Omega Euromasters from Kranz-sur-Cher in Switzerland. The LPGA held the CP Women's Open from the Shaughnessy Golf Course in Vancouver, British Columbia, and it's a result that has been delayed due to rain, and we'll bring that for you next week. They move on, though, this weekend to the Portland Classic from Columbia Edgewater. Horse racing and some results for our fancies at the Big York Festival last week. In the Great Voltigeur, sadly, Gregory could only finish third. The Judmont International, Mossadaf, took the scalp of Paddington. And the Lowther, we gave you the 1-2. Relief Rally beating Cherry Blossom. The Lonsdale Cup, we also gave you the 1-2 with Coltrane beating Courage Mon Ami. However, our selection in the Gymcrack Killian could only finish fifth. The City of York Stakes, we gave you the winner in Kinross. And in the Ebor, we gave you four horses to look out for. And they finished first, second and third with absurd winning for Willie Mullins and Frankie Dettori. Sweet William being second and Live Your Dream under top weight finishing third. If you gambled and done the trifecta, you'd be claiming £369.80 for your £1 stake. Some big races coming up on the 9th of September. We've got the Irish Champion Stakes with the aforementioned Mossadaf and the English Derby runner-up King of Steel. And the Sprint Cup at Haydock Park with Shaquille and Kinross both going for that. We love Shaquille, but Kinross is a horse that you can never get down. The week after, on the 16th of September, Caesar St. Ledger. We like Gregory still, even though he flopped at York. Desert Hero and Save the Last Dance would be two to note if they go for the race. Tennis, and it's the start of the US Open, the final major of the season. And the men, obviously Carlos Alcaraz, who we would put forward. Novak Djokovic, the legend. And some outsiders, Jannik Sinner, Holger Rune and Casper Ruud. And in the women's, Iga Swiatek and Aryna Sabalenka are two favourite players. Look out for Jessica Pegula, homegirl Corey Golf and Ons Jabeur. On to motorsport. MotoGP is back this week with the Grand Premier de Catalunya from the circuit of Barcelona. Frankie Bagnaia from the Ducati Lenovo team lead the standings. World Superbikes are still on their summer break and are not back till the 8th or the 10th of September with Pirelli French round from Circuit Manicourt. Alvaro Bautista leads the way for the Ducati Aruba IT team. British Superbike has round 8 with races 22, 23 and 24 from Caldwell Park using the full circuit. Glenn Irwin won the sprint race for the Beer Monster Ducati team. Second and third were the two OMG Racing Yamaha riders, Carl Ride and Ryan Vickers. We'll bring you results of races 2 and 3 next week. The standings are still led though by Tommy Bridewell. Beer Monster Ducati, 274 points, but just 19 behind now his teammate Glenn Irwin on 254.5, with 30 points back to Jason O'Halloran for the McCann's Yamaha with 224.5. Round 9 is on the 15th to the 17th of September from Alton Park using the international circuit. The Speedway Grand Prix is back from their summer break this weekend with the British Grand Prix from Cardiff, and Bartosz Smarsik leads the standings. In NASCAR, the Coke Zero 400 from Daytona International Speedway was won by Chris Buescher, driving his Ford Mustang for RFK Racing, with his teammate Brad Keselowski in second, and a further Ford Mustang, but this time for Stuart Haas Racing, Eric Amola, making it a 1-2-3 for Ford. The standings are led by William Byron in his Chevy Camaro on 2,036 points on countback from Martin Truex Jr., who had the same number of points but less wins, with Denny Hamlin in third on 2025. And we start the playoffs now, the round of 16, with the Cookout Southern 500 at Darlington Raceway. IndyCar and the Bombarito Automotive Group 500 from the Worldwide Tech Raceway was won in brilliant fashion again with a fuel-save drive from Scott Dixon in his Chip Ganassi car. Second place, Pato O'Ward, Arrows McLaren, and third place, Davin Belukas, driving for Dale Coyne Racing. Alex Palou for Chip Ganassi leads the standings on 565 points. He's now fully 74 points clear of the closing Scott Dixon, his teammate in the Chip Ganassi team. But with only two races left, it's only Scott Dixon that can now overhaul Alex Palou. Joseph Newgarden back in third for Team Penske on 440. This penultimate race is this weekend with the Bitnile.com Grand Prix of Portland from Portland International Raceway. Formula One held the Dutch Grand Prix from Zandvoort, and it was won by home favourite Max Verstappen, unsurprisingly, equaling Sebastian Vettel's record of 9 in a row. Second place, Fernando Alonso in the Aston Martin, and third place, Pierre Gasly for Alpine after Sergio Perez picked up a time penalty. It was a race that was raining, then dry, raining, then dry, and it was very tricky, and a brilliant win by Max. Lewis Hamilton dropped back to last after a bad call from Mercedes and finished fifth. Max Verstappen leads the standings on 339 points. His teammate Sergio Perez 138 behind on 201. Fernando Alonso is third in the Aston Martin on 168. Red Bull lead the standings on 540 points. Way back at Mercedes in second on 255, and they're 40 points clear of Aston Martin on 215. This week sees the Italian Grand Prix from Monza. We finish with football. Week 3's results. Chelsea 3, Luton 0, Bournemouth 0, Tottenham 2, Brentford 1, Crystal Palace 1, Arsenal 2, Fulham 2, Manchester United 3, Nottingham Forest 2, Everton 0, Wolves 1, Brighton 1, West Ham 3, Sheffield United 1, Manchester City 2, Burnley 1, Aston Villa 3, and Newcastle 1, Liverpool 2. Great performance by Liverpool, coming from 1-0 down with 10 men. The top three in the league see Manchester City, the only team left in the league with a 100% record with 9 points, 3 games. Then we have four tied on 7 points from 3 games. West Ham, Tottenham, Liverpool and Arsenal. Week 4's fixtures, Luton versus West Ham, Sheffield United versus Everton, Manchester City versus Fulham, Chelsea versus Nottingham Forest, Burnley versus Tottenham, Brentford versus Bournemouth, Brighton versus Newcastle, Crystal Palace versus Wolves, Liverpool versus Aston Villa, and the game of the weekend, Arsenal versus Manchester United. That's our SLB Sports Roundup. Well, everyone, that's the end of another brilliant show, the last of August. I want to say a huge thank you to our three remarkable guests, Professor Green, Faye Tunnicliffe and Holly Mile. Also to you, the listeners, and all our sponsors. And finally, Johan, Raffaella and the whole team at UK Health Radio, who give us this amazing platform. We'll see you all next week.